said, we're going to share one or two more, and then we'll just have a chat, and we'll go from there. Cool. So this next one is a bit more nebulous. It's not so kind of directly related to the theme, I think, and some of the issues that affect the theme, but it's something I wanted to put in there anyway, because I think it relates in a more esoteric sense. Anyway, I'm not going to explain it too much. It's a poem that I don't often perform. It's called Fear. It goes like this. Nothing is to be feared, only to be understood. Intoxicated often does what the sober would. If he thought he could, if he had the power, he'd abuse it, and that seems clear to me. Because what is fear to me is also dear to me. Because pain is the price of what I hold near to me, to which I'm attached and I can't light the match. If I did, I'd see everything I think I lack is right here already. We're a part of it, not the end, and nor are we the start of it. Put apart nonetheless, scared as what ifs under flesh and everything I can't possess. So instead I disconnect, and to numb the stress, take a blunder guess. Rather than know, I don't know and just accept. I view it as a test, and I must pass. It's only real if it's something that I must grasp. Nothing else counts a bit if I can't count it quick. So let us count figures. Let's count figures. Figures in the bank, figures mowed down by tanks. The steel boot of the figure stamps on the ants. But they were more than figures. We ain't figured that we need them. And we're projecting the reflection of how we're really feeling. When we kick them, kill them, leave them there, dying, bleeding. And say they did it first, we are just getting even. You see, we hate ourselves, that's why we act this way. When we strike out, we should punch ourselves in the face. That is what we're really doing. Got no clue what we're pursuing. The mirror or the million, what are we really viewing? We could take a microscope and analyze atoms. Or telescopes to the sky, the same thing happens. It's the same picture. They both go on forever. So when we place limits on things, is that clever? In fact, I define myself by my limitations, my station or my status or my silly faith in papers. The type that I read or the type that say they've read. The type for which they bleed or the type that say they bled. And now the ego's fed, but never had its fill. So until we shed, let's accept the deal. We will steal and will kill just for the thrill. That's my dose of truth. Give me the blue pill and let me swallow. Wallow now in my sorrow. The one to find my own truth. It's easier to borrow. Thanks very much, ladies and gentlemen. Piece number two. So I've got two more reflections, I suppose, I want to share with you. And then we'll open up the floor. We've got some roving mics. Who's holding the roving mics? I want to point out the people who are... There's going to be someone holding some roving mics, just so you know. And so we'll open up the floor and have a little bit of a chat. Hopefully everyone's got some opinions on the subject matter. Just opinions generally, and we can just... I'm going to attempt to occupy this couch, though it is currently occupied, but I'll do my best. But I've got two more pieces I want to share with you before we open up the floor. And I've got some... I'm going to push the conversation in particular directions if enough questions don't get asked and stuff like that, because I have my own opinions and my own reflections. But I'd like to hear from you as well. So this one right here, it's actually a song of mine. It was on an album I released in 2010 called Doublethink. And it's an a cappella version of the song, essentially, because I think the song very much relates. It's a song called Find No Enemy. And it goes like this. Apparently, I'm second generation Black Caribbean and half white Scottish. Whatever that means. See, lately, I feel confused with the boxes. Because to me, all they do is breed conflict. It's not that I've lost touch with reality of racism, sexism, and nationality. Just to me, all seems like insanity. Why must I rob you of your humanity to feel good about mine? It's all about crime, dehumanizing, how I justify them. So I must keep lying about the history of Africa so I can live with the massacres and repeat my mantra. Muslim, terrorist, so I can sleep at night as bombs take flight. Eyes open wide, but I'm blind to the sight. Too busy chasing the perfect life and the working class keep them uneducated. Truly educated men could never be a racist. To educate is to draw out what is within. Are we not all the same under the skin? I got a heart like yours that pumps blood and oxygen. And insecurities, a whole lot of them. I'm scared like you deep down. I really do care that the world's not fair like you. But don't even believe my own prayers like you. Chasing career, going nowhere like you. Lost in the fog of my own insecurity. I hold myself up as an image of purity. And I judge everybody else by the color of their skin or size of their wealth. But it's not good for my health, is the only one I ever really judge is myself. Oppressors must suffer, like the oppressed, though I pretend to be in control of this mess by inflating my ego, puffing my chest. See a weakness and a need to show strength for what we think strong is. Because if we're honest, true strength is the strength to be honest. And if I'm honest, I am just tired. If I'm honest, I am just tired. Tired of every day filling up my car, knowing that I'm paying for the bombs in Iraq. Tired of pretending it don't hurt my heart, of wanting change, not knowing where to start. Tired of listening to all the conditioning and all the forms that they got me filling in. Next time you see what you think is a fog and despise him, please know I was just like him. Cause I was like 8 first time I saw crack. Same time I first smoked weed, choking on blowbacks. First time I saw knives penetrate flesh, meat cleavers to the back of the head. And as I grew and teenage years passed, many more knives pierced and the shots blast. And I ain't saying I had the worst upbringing, but there's a million young men just like me in prison. We complain about racism and elevate clowns with their trousers down, swinging they round. Maybe that is not quite literal, but everything they do is just a stereotypical. To my real fans, I feel your pain, and I get the messages, but don't complain that we ain't got more fame. We're playing our part. They can keep the charts. All I want is your hearts. They can keep the charts. All I want is your hearts. They can keep the charts. All I want is your hearts. Call it black radio. Don't make me laugh. So is black music all about tits and ain't represent nothing, they just pretending. When was the last time they ever played Hendrix or Miles Davis or John Coltrane or Ella Fitzgerald or Billie Holiday? We can call it urban. To me, that's cool. If urban means street, that includes jazz too. And rock for that matter. Go ask Mick Jagger or Jimmy Page what they were listening to. The blues, not discrediting Love Zeppelin too. Just giving credit where credit is due. And that blood-soaked word rappers still use. All it really shows is we still self-abuse. That was the word that was used to kill Kelso Coltrane and Emmett Till. That was the word that the conscience eased and made people pleased to hang you from trees. That was the word that let the whips crack. No matter what we say, we could never take it back. And I could say they're black, so I feel their pain easier. But 1915, look at Armenia. It's the whole world, this elite stupidity that would take us all to death, quite literally. And I can talk with my comfortable mouth, comfortable clothes, comfortable house. And it may sound like I'm bitter, but in fact, truth be told, I am quite the opposite. I wake every day and I'm overwhelmed just to be alive and be like no one else. And the sheer weight of the thought of space is enough to keep my little ego in place. All that we chase and try to replace. All along, it was right in our face. The only way we could ever change anything. Look in the mirror and to find no enemy. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Okay, this is my last reflection I'm going to perform before we open up the floor and have a little bit of a talk. And I think this one is most directly connected to the theme, which is why I saved it till last. It was inspired by a collection of different literature I've read, which I'm going to reflect on. But one particular book, there's a book called It's Bigger Than Hip Hop by a gentleman who I met about 2 years ago, a professor, young professor called M.K. Asante. He was actually at the time the youngest professor in American history. He got his professorship at 23 years old, though his employment at the university didn't last tremendously long for political reasons, I suppose you could say, which is a whole nother discussion. But his work has been very inspirational for me and for other young hip-hop artists, looking at the political and social implications of the music we make, looking at what gave birth to this music art form that we say we love so much, etc., etc., etc. His dad was also a very esteemed professor as well. And so, yeah, this sections of this song, I suppose, were directly inspired by that book and its reflections on the criminal justice system in America and the issues that affect and relate to justice in that country. It goes like this. Oh, you can watch this online as well, by the way. The last one I just done was called Find No Enemy. That's on YouTube. This one's called Fire in the Booth Part 1. I've done 3 of those, but they're online, so you can watch them if you want to. Akala, Fire in the Booth, just in case you don't catch everything, because it's quite fast. Yes, I grew up an adult in a single parent family. Been through a little bit of tragedy. Yes, I was around drugs and violence before the day that I started secondary. And that's part of it, not half of it. Get the picture, the rest ain't necessary. Growing up, got a little caught up. But that ain't even half of my life. I was also given the knowledge of self. That is all we actually need to survive. So if you saw me, age 9, reading Malcolm, just fine. Teachers still treated me stupid. Students that couldn't speak English, they put me in groups with. And the irony is, some of the first men to give me schooling, you were called gangsters. But I already explained that we know what the truth is. They used to say, don't be like me. Yeah, I got a name and don't on the street, but nighttime comes, I can't sleep. That's the part fake rappers don't speak. We don't hit the road because we're thugs. Don't come out the womb, want to sell drugs. If we got the right guidance and love, would we fight people just like us? How could I knock the hustle to get by? How do you think I ate as a child? Judge no one, done many things wrong. Just don't boast about it in songs, but listen to my older bars. I was just as confused as you probably are, but you grow when you learn. Travel one cup, one too many man, you know, get cut up. One too many man that could have been doctors end up spending their whole life boxed up. You learn, if you study, it's all set out just to make them money. No cover, it's all about getting poor people to fight with one another. So it's logical that us killing our brothers, dissing our mothers is right in line with the dominant philosophy of our time. But time is a cycle, not a line. When it comes back around, you regain your mind. You be ready for the energy, I channel them a rhyme. Remedy the pedigree, the jeopardy of your mind. When the world's this, lethargy's a crime. We can all fight with the brothers over crumbs. It's harder to fight the one who makes guns. We can all talk shit and get $2. Harder to be the one who seeks knowledge. If we understood economics with no money's nothing, think nothing of it. Money is a means to get wealth, not the wealth itself, and don't get confused. Far from wrote all that you see me do, I own, but I won't hang what I make around my neck. I know from where the diamonds came, but I do literally own a library that definitely costs more than your chain and businesses and property. Far from starving, I eat quite properly, and I don't care. I just said it for the kids who need to know you're not broke to listen. Don't know an asset from a liability, because they've never been shown nor told the difference, so they don't change situation. The richest man in Britain is Asian, and that's significant, not coincidence, because when Asian people build their businesses, not by flossing and going out shopping and giving up the culture for everyone's profit. Who runs Bollywood? Indian people. Who runs rap? There's the difference. So we shake our ass and dance as if racism just upped and vanished. But has it? No, it's right on course. You're beaten so bad you're trained to ignore. Let me not just make sweeping statements. Give me a second, I'll explain it. For small personal amounts of drug possession, there's more black people in jail in America than there is for rape and armed robbery and murder all put together. And you can say they're just locking up thugs, but imagine they imprisoned every middle class kid that had ever held drugs. Oh, that's right, that'd be your kids. See, it's bigger than that. What is going on with this? Prison in America's private business. They get paid 50K per year per inmate by the state. Just wait. Also legally are allowed to use their prison inmates as slaves, a cheap slave labor for big corporations. They come out of jail when they can't get a job. So when we celebrate going to jail, we are literally celebrating enslavement. Add to that, the hood that you live in, engineered social condition, that breeds crime by design. Where do you think you get your nine? And we can say that they're just black. But I like to deal with facts. In the 1920s, you would have found in America black towns that were prospering centers of economics and education to make you proud. But some people couldn't bear that the former slaves would not just lie down, so the KKK and other hate groups burn those towns to the ground, killing hundreds. If it ain't understood, you think you were always living in the hood. It's only been 60 years since the hung blacks and burn them, and that was so cool. There were your baskets, picnic baskets, even gave kids the day off school. Go see a lynching, have a picnic. It's fun to watch the little monkeys die. Then people act a little dysfunctional. We want to pretend that we don't know why. If you look means you could be killed, and you're powerless to get justice about it. It's difficult to figure out how you would then end up feeling about it, and that ain't excuses. I'm just dealing with the roots of abuses that make a reality where a generation of young men speak of ourselves as dirt casually. That's America. This Britain. Something similar, some different. In this country, the first enslaved were the working class. What's changed? Worse jobs, worse conditions, most tax. Look where you live in. You go to the pub. Friday night, you will fight with a guy. Don't know what for. Won't fight with a guy in a suit and a tie who sends your kids to die in a war. They don't send the kids of the rich or the politicians. It's your kids, the poor British, that they send to go and die in a foreign land for these wars that you don't understand. Yeah, they say you are British and that lovely patriotism they feed you, but in reality, you have more in common with immigrants than with your leaders. I know both sides of my family, black and white, a fed ghetto mentality, reality in this system. Poor people are dirt regardless of shade. But with that said, let's not pretend that everything is the same. When our grandparents came here to Britain, if you had a criminal record, you couldn't get in. When our grandparents came here to Britain, if you had a criminal record, you couldn't get in. That ain't protect them from all of the stupid abuses they would be living. Kicked in the teeth, stabbed in the street. Many times firebombed our houses, put feces through our letterbox, and of course the cops did so much about it daily. Up to the 80s, people spitting in my pram because I was a coon baby. But of course, that has had no effect on why today we are crazy. And none of this was for any good reason. They were just dark and breathing to ease the guilt now for all of this treatment. Constant stereotypes are needed. So if I celebrate how big that my bricks that I'm flipping, chicks that I'm sticking, clips that I'm hitting, I'm playing my position. But if I teach your kids to be a mathematician, I'm messing with the schism. How are we going to fill a prison when materialism is no longer our religion? What do you think we got now in Britain? Just like America. Private prison. Prison for profit. So that means when young people go jail, people make money off it. So keep environments that breed crime, build more jails at the same time, market badness to the kids in the rhymes, long as rich kids ain't dying, it's fine. Get them to the point where some are so lost, they actually believe if they don't celebrate killing themselves off, to better, it's because they're soft. Was Malcolm soft? Was Marley soft? Tell me, was Muhammad Ali soft? Well, was Marcus Garvey soft? Nah, I think not, but they want us to think that the road is cool. Being on road is all we could do, but we don't control the wholesale production, so who benefits from us moving the food or thinking there's no way out of road life? But Malcolm X used to hustle on the roadside, and Marcus Garvey organized more than 6 million people with no Facebook or Twitter. Why is it something you can't equal? Shh. One of my own homeboys did a 10 straight in the boxing yard. Now what's he doing? Passing his doctorate. Don't tell me that it's too hard. Who trained you to believe you're inferior? Your Songbo Erudo in Nigeria are the remains of an ancient moat. Dug 1,000 years ago. It's 20 meters wide, 70 down. Round the remains of an ancient town. That's 400 square miles around. 400 square miles around. Please don't believe me. It was a documentary on BBC, but we ain't studying history. Too busy watching MTV. And MTV said, wear platinum. Now everybody want to go and wear platinum. And MTV said, pop magnum. Now everybody want to go and pop magnum. If MTV said, drink prune juice, you would start hearing that in tune soon. Hey, today I never wore my Cartier. Is it now less important what I got to say? Oh, if I drive a Mercedes, by the way, should everyone listen to what I got to say? Does that make us all happy? Ah, but my head's still nappy. Think for myself. So some mad at me. Put on a mic, ain't not one batters me. All of this here's good for the rhymes. It put us in the same place at the same time, and it's clear to everybody I'm out of my mind. Some of these guys are running out of my rhymes. Clear to everybody. That's got ears. I'm the guy that they just might fear. They don't want to get near, but they can't have a peer. Oh dear, I'm hard. Look at you just like beer. Front on a kid for another 5 years, but come to my shows and some criteria see it mean that much to them. It's a movement. I don't speak for myself, but a unit. Black, white, man, woman. Anyone who respects truth, we put in. The dudes are like, no dinner, we're just pudding. Yeah, you're sweet, but no substance pudding. So you can never ever be with Avalon. Our songs get played out there. Lebanon, we speak for the people properly, not for the old fat guys in offices and the girls love him. It ain't fair, I can't even be bothered to comb his hair. Anyway, that's enough kissing my own. Back to the more important task of being so shower that I got half a hoodie screaming, knowledge is power. And I ain't saying that I change rap back, but I do know this for a fact. Right now there's a youth on your block with his hands on his face screwed up. Swear he don't care, that he don't give a, that he won't let nobody call his bluff, but the words go in. Open your chakras. Once that's happened, there is no going backwards. You start to see what is really happening. Who the enemy should be attacking is. So read. Stuck on the block. Read. Sitting in the box. Read. Don't let them say what you can achieve. Because when people are enslaved, one of the first things they do is stop them reading. Because it is well understood that intelligent people will take their freedom. Because if we knew our power, we would understand we can't be held down. If we knew our power, we would not elevate not one of these clowns. If we knew our power, we wouldn't get arrogant when we get 2 pennies. If we knew our power, we would see what everybody sees, that we're rich already. But never mind MCs, go run for your mummy. I'm hungry, I run for my tummy. That's enough. Back to worshipping money. I'm off. Back to the study. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Okay, brilliant. Okay, so I might have a seat. In fact, I'm going to have a seat. And yeah, we... Thank you very much. Thank you. We wanted to open the floor. We've got one radio mic here, and we've got one over there. And I don't think this stretches all the way over there, so no, I'm not going to. Or maybe it does. It's all right. I'll just stay on the stage. I don't mind being up here. Yeah, we wanted to open up the floor and have a debate or a discussion or reflection on justice, criminal justice, youth, the way these things interact and intersect. If anyone's got an opinion or opinions and wants to open up the floor and push the discussion in a particular direction, feel free to. We got one here.
Hello.
Hello, how you doing?
Good, thanks. I just always thought it was interesting how violence is treated with different classes. Like, I know this is quite a random example, but you know the celebrity Charlie Sheen? Like, everyone loves him and stuff, but a few years ago he was arrested for abusing his wife, and nobody ever talks about that, and everyone still loves him. Like, he was fine. He can carry on being famous or whatever, and it's all good, but... If somebody's working class, like, that wouldn't be, it wouldn't be forgiven at all at any time. They'd be, have to go to prison. It'd be very hard for them to get a job again, and it's just very difficult. Oh, and also, I thought it was interesting with the Boston bomber case, how they had a cover of him on Rolling Stone magazine, and they had, like, a picture of him where he was, like, looking all good and stuff, and I think they were trying to make him into a bit of, like, a rock star kind of person who was, like, just a bit, like, he had some problems in his life. I feel like they were... trying to do it like that, and I thought it was interesting how I think if he wasn't white, it probably that wouldn't have happened. They wouldn't have tried to make a kind of excuses like that, like, you know, he was just guy with issues type thing. But yeah,
he's an isolated individual. He doesn't have to worry about, or his people that look like him don't have to worry about his behavior reflecting badly on them. I'll give you an example, another media example, which I found quite hilarious. I was laughing quite a lot. I was in Australia when the terrorist attack happened in Norway, the guy who killed almost 100 people. And he was referred to on the news, the main news in Australia, as exhibiting terrorist-like tactics. I want you to think about that, right? This guy killed almost 100 people, made it very clear that he had a political motive for doing so, but was referred to as being terrorist-like because, of course, being blonde-haired and blue-eyed, he couldn't possibly have been that evil and that bad all by himself. He must have been influenced by some crazy Muslims from the Middle East, which, of course, who we know they mean when they say terrorists, right? So these things do subtly go in, and you're right. The relationship between privilege and bad behavior and the way your bad behavior or immoral behavior will be interpreted relating to your economic status, your race, your religion, where in the world you're born, all of those different, what gender you are, what sexual persuasion you are, all of those different categories of privilege or non-privilege definitely relate to an impact upon how your crime will be interpreted. And that's the way it is for the time being.
Hi, Carla. I'm a massive fan. I'm loving what you're doing. I saw you, I think it was last year, you were talking about Egypt, basically, and you were with a griot artist, I think.
Yeah.
And I wanted to wonder what everyone else's opinion was on the way music can feed into making people want to commit crime. When I saw you last, you gave an example of a Professor Green song and some of the lyrics that he was saying and how people interpreted it wrong. I can't remember the specific example, but I think, does anyone else have any other influences where there are music that is fueling violence or can be fueling negative? Because obviously we know that there's loads of music out there that can fuel positivity, but there's also a lot of music that's really popular that can fuel people wanting to commit crimes. So that's what I was asking.
Do we have before we move on to that one, do we have any direct responses to that? Is that a direct response to that? We've got one here and one here.
Have you ever heard of the rapper Eminem? Yeah. Yeah, obviously. Yeah. That was stupid. I think he's a really good rapper and everything, but like, some of his lyrics are like really intense and about real bad crimes, and like he's literally trying to make it sound like really cool to do all that stuff, and like he's saying like, oh yeah, you're a wimp, you won't rap about anything that I'm saying because
I think it's also the idea of like big, all the big music, like you know, the new Miley Cyrus song, We Can't Stop. It was all about kind of drugs and partying, but it didn't show the bad side. It always just showed the good side, all the fun of it, when it's not going to be good. It's going to just go down and be all bad. And that's something I don't like. It's the media. It always shows the good side of, like, partying, drinking lots of alcohol, taking illegal drugs, and all stuff like that. It never shows the bad.
Responses to that? Have we got one here and one there?
In response to that question, a lot of my friends like sort of listen to Odd Future and sort of Earl Sweatshirt and people like that. And what advice would you sort of give to people like me that sort of don't think that's what music's about and that they want to sort of avoid that kind of music? As much as I like hip hop and rap and all that, you want to sort of avoid that kind of music because it's not, I don't think that's really what music's about and all that. So,
Robin Thicke's new song, The Blurred Lines. I mean, funny enough, when I first heard it, because I don't listen to lyrics, like No Scrubs by TLC, I didn't listen to lyrics until later on. But I didn't listen to the lyrics of the Robin Thicke song. And when I did, and I saw the XXX rated video that came with it, I mean, generally, a lot of hip hop is very, very anti-woman. You know, it's anti-woman, it's anti any other sexuality that isn't straight, you know, boisterous the male. And, you know, the fact that it really does dishearten me that and the Miley Cyrus song were actually big sellers of this year, because it does say a lot, I think it does say a lot about our community, it does say a lot about society as a whole, and it does say a lot about, you know, how people can listen to that kind of song and just take all of that music that can be that anti-women and that pro-rape, if you want to put it that way, seriously. And like, yeah, that's great, let's put it in the club, let's dance. Yeah.
All right, go on. Two more responses to that one. I don't want to stop the flow, stem the flow of the discussion.
I just had one more response, sorry. And it was about people using, like, satire and irony and stuff in their lyrics, and I think that gets used a lot, and then it's not in like sound to interpretation, so people might be mocking these ideas or these mind frames, and yet the general public or the press take it as them supporting those mind frames and those ideas. So there's a difficulty of using music as communication. Like, you're quite direct with what you say, and you do use irony and satire and stuff, but along with everything else you're saying, it makes people know where you stand, and that's the problem of, I guess, selling music rather than just making music.
Okay. What I was going to say was actually in response to what you said about the Robin Thicke song, because I didn't realise until I listened to the lyrics, it's so degrading, and it feels like there's so many songs that are encouraging women they do need to degrade themselves in order to be accepted or anything. And that's why we have so many issues with like fashion, the way people think, because they feel like they're never going to be any more, because we can't see all this music telling you that you have to act, you have to look, you have to think and do certain things. And I just think it's so disgusting. It's really refreshing when you hear music that doesn't do that.
On the same line, sort of in the Robin Thicke song, it's got such a catchy hook, so when you first hear it, everyone really loves it. But then it is actively promoting rape culture on a massive scale.
You know, I don't know the lyrics of this song, so I'm going to go.
Oh, go, yeah, go look them up. It's all about blurred lines.
I'm shocked by what you guys are telling me. I mean, I heard there was an X-rated video.
Oh, yeah, not just the X-rated video, the lyrics.
This is what you're saying about sexual abuse is news to me.
It's pretty much saying that no can mean yes, and there's blurred lines, and that women, you know, or, yeah. It's like good girls, bad girls, good girls always want it, and it's really quite horrific
right, okay.
In how it does that.
The one with Pharrell we're talking about.
Yeah, Pharrell and Robin Thicke.
Yeah.
And it's been number one on the charts for a really long time, and when it comes on, I know a lot of people who are just like, yeah, but it's really good, you can just ignore that part.
Yeah.
And the two guys who did it, they said, oh, we're just married, it's fine, because we respect our wives, this is just a bit of fun that we're having. They don't realise what damage they're doing to the people who listen to the music. Yeah, exactly.
Well,
sort of walking around naked.
I think we got one.
I was just going to say, even Gangnam Style, like that was massive, and you had little kids dancing to it and families dancing to it, but the actual underlying message of that song was pretty disgusting, really.
I don't know what the underlying message of
Gangnam
that song is.
Style. Huh? Gangnam Style. I don't know. I took it as gang rape, basically, or rape,
really?
Or sex. Yeah, and the dance is like hitting an X.
Okay. I'd have to look into that one. I don't want to make that accusation without knowing, but you might well be right. I don't know. I think what's important is also that discussions around hip-hop are not had in isolation. What I find is many of the points being raised are tremendously valid, but the way they're generally raised in the mainstream culture is in complete isolation. You've got these bad rap guys that no one knows how has any idea how they got so famous or so wealthy, as if they're not supported by mainstream radio, as if they're not supported by very wealthy, respected corporations, as if they don't have a fan base in the millions of people who live in nice homes and nice houses who have, you know, okay lives. You know, we get quite moralistic in the dialogue around hip-hop, but we don't look at what hip-hop is actually telling us about the society we live in and the relationship between this music, the people that buy it, and the people that promote and own and control it. Because the artists that we're talking about are a very small number of people, right? 10, 15, 20 artists maybe you're criticizing that have this commercial platform. But the apparatus around them, all the A&Rs, all of the people in the music industry, the radio pluggers, the TV pluggers, the people who fund them, are way, way more people. But they're never brought up and they're never presented as part of the problem. Similarly with the consumers, we're not forced to buy a particular style of music, but we do buy it, you know. And obviously I know there's that relationship between what's promoted and what's pushed in your face and how that manufactures design. So I would like to see the dialogues around hip-hop placed kind of within a larger context of what's going on in society and where hip-hop fits in and what hip-hop's relationship is, particularly in the United States, the relationship and the control of the images of African-Americans and what that's meant historically for America, and why a particular type of over-sexualized, violent, misogynistic image seems to find it so much easier to get a platform than a Mos Def or an Erykah Badu or a Jill Scott or any of these other artists that are much more positive, have something much more interesting to say, in my opinion at least, that have all demonstrated that they can sell records and have a fan base over a consistently long period of time, yet they will not get the same level of mainstream attention. And that's not really dialogued about enough. You know, we have to ask why and what does that mean, I think. Any other points to discussion? Anything else anyone wants to
What do you think about, in the American justice system, especially with the death penalty, there's been a lot of cases where you have two people who are sort of arrested for drug crimes, and there'll be one person who might be like from an African-American poorer background, and you'll have a middle-class, often white person. And because of the fact that a lot of it's about who can get the better lawyer, and it means that they might get off some of the charges. So what do you think about the fact that in America, even though it's treated the same maybe in arrests, like because of who can afford the better lawyer, it becomes unequal?
Well, I would go further than that. I would say the American system is more unequal and more systemically and deliberately so. So if we look historically, so we can get a genuine sense on how the American justice system came to where it is today. The 13th Amendment to the American Constitution that we are taught to celebrate as ending slavery did not end slavery in America. What the 13th Amendment to the American Constitution specifically said was slavery was now illegal except for persons who had committed a crime or a felony, right? So there was this relationship immediately between breaking the law and slavery. And that was made then and there in 1865 from that point forward. What happened at that point was 4 million African Americans who are now free but don't have a home and don't own any property and were not given any reparations or any kind of economic empowerment to move forward. So it was non-economic emancipation. Even though they'd fought in the Civil War and helped win the Civil War, they were not given any tools to move forward. A set of laws came into play in the same period, making theft and homelessness criminal. So what essentially happened was you had a massive, and there's very good books on this as well, one called Slavery by Another Name. You had massive re-enslavement of African Americans immediately after the Civil War under the guise of, well, they've stolen a chicken or a hen or a pot of soup or they're homeless, right? So vagabondage. So you had a system by where race was no longer the explicitly stated issue, but the intent was clear, the disproportional infliction of justice or injustice was clear. I would fast forward 100 years to the announcement of the war on drugs, you know, and you have Richard Nixon and one of his aides making the comment that, and this is an exact comment, it's quoted in MK Asante's book, It's Bigger Than Hip Hop, you can go and look up how this comment came out because it was recorded. Richard Nixon said, the entire problem is the blacks, and the key is to have a system that recognizes this without appearing to do so. That was in reference to the war on drugs, right? So if you then have a scenario where drugs have been made illegal, now we saw what happened, and we all have studied the period of history in American history where alcohol was made illegal. What was the result of alcohol being made illegal? Drive-bys, gangland shootings, mass killings. African Americans were not massively involved in this. It was Al Capone, it was Italians, it was Irish, it was Jewish gangsters in this period of time. But we fast forward to the war on drugs, and you have a situation where 5 grams of crack cocaine is 100 times more severely sentenced than cocaine. So 5 grams of crack cocaine gets you the same time in prison as 0.5 kilo of powder cocaine. Does that make sense? So it's a drug that isn't explicitly racialized, right? And it doesn't explicitly say these are who we want to put in prison and who we don't. But the effect, and the desired effect, I would argue, if you look at what was being said by the people behind it, was to imprison, and as I mentioned in that rap, you have more African Americans in jail today for personal, I'm not talking about drug dealers, I'm talking personal amounts of drug possession. You have more African Americans in jail for personal, individual amounts of drug possession than you do for rape, armed robbery, and murder all put together. So if it's criminals we're trying to get off the streets, we have to ask ourselves another thing. Tim Wise, a white American anti-racist, quoted a study done in America that showed, on top of all of that, white men are 4.5 times more likely to actually have drugs on them when they are stopped. Not my statement, the police's own studies. He quotes this in an online talk. You can Google it. It's called The Pathology of White Privilege. So if we know that groups of people use drugs relatively evenly, or at least in some cases, people who can afford it, maybe use drugs even more, yet we place the resources for policing drugs only in particular communities, you can have a system that has the desired effect without having to explicitly state this is what you want to achieve. Does that make sense? And so for me, the issue is much bigger than individual acts of bias and individual judges and people not being able to afford lawyers. I would argue, actually, that part of the American justice system's function is to have that racialized skew, because part of American society, since its inception, has had that racialized skew. I could give you a whole list of names of unarmed African Americans that you've probably never heard of that have been murdered by the police in the last 10 years, it doesn't become news. It's not referred to as terrorism. We can talk about Rico Boyd, who was a woman. We can talk about Kenneth Chamberlain, who was an elderly, retired, former Marine in his home. And the entire incident of the police breaking into his house and murdering him was caught. He was a heart patient. And so he had one of these medical instruments tied to his chest. If you lean on it, it calls the medical establishment. He did that by mistake. It also calls the police. This is all online. You can look it up. And the police came to his home, but the phone call is still recording his interaction with the police. He's petrified. The police are knocking on his door. He's like, I don't want you to come in. Please leave me alone. Like, you haven't been called out for a crime. I'm just an elderly heart patient. Leave me alone. They're at his door, racially abusing him. They kick off his door, and they shoot him to death. And this is 4 or 5 years ago, right? So these incidents, I would say, are systemic. This kind of stuff is still happening. It's not, you know, the dream that people want to reflect on of a post-racial America just because of what's going on in the White House doesn't exist, in my view. And that impacts the criminal justice system. These police have not been put in jail. Neither have any of the other people who've killed all these list of other persons. So the issue is systemic, and I think only by acknowledging and understanding that it's systemic can we ever get over it. If we present these people as individual acts of bigotry and present the problem as individual acts of bigotry, we're never going to get to the root cause of why what's going on is going on, in my opinion.
Hello, yes, I work for the youth offending team in London, and as part of my placement, I have to go to different universities, societies across the UK and speak to them about my experience and run workshops and basically talk about youth and criminal justice. In your experience, when you've gone to places around the UK, how do you make the topic of youth and criminal justice relevant to areas which may not have high levels of youth crime, whereas in London the levels of youth crime is predominantly high, so I can go to universities and colleges and speak to the students about it, but when you go to other places that may not have that sort of problem,
like Tottenham, maybe.
Yeah,
well, it's difficult. It's like anything, right? Privilege allows us to not care about what we don't have to care about. So as a man, my last worry when I'm walking home late at night is that a group of women are going to attack me on my way home. It's never occurred to me ever in my entire life have I seen a group of women on the other side of the street and thought, better walk the other way, it's a dark alley over there, right? Because privilege allows me to not care about what I don't have to care about. Does that make sense? Whether that's racial, whether that's economic, whether that's relationship to crime, whether that's class. And so the difficulty is that it takes empathy, right? And empathy is something we're not encouraged to have in society. You know, we're encouraged to buy stuff, but we're not encouraged to have empathy with other human beings and make that our first priority to reach out beyond our own personal levels of comfort and privilege and see what other groups of people are suffering, what other groups of people are going through, and understand their struggles. And so there are ways of making these things relevant. I think music has proved historically to be a massive vehicle for doing that, which is why music has been, in my view, so heavily controlled by the media, so heavily controlled by governments, not just this one, but going back historically, I mean, there's passages in the Bible about singers and players of instruments being coveted by people in government, right? And that's 2,000 years ago, right? So this power that the artist has to engage people from various different backgrounds, to engage people from all different social strata with a particular issue is part of why I believe artists have been demonized. And so for me, I just try to use my art without compromising what I'm saying and where I come from, but still trying to be inclusive and make people understand how injustice anywhere affects justice everywhere. And okay, today these issues might not affect you, but tomorrow they might. And so I think it's important for people to see and humanize those people we're always taught to not humanize. Does that make sense? You know, stories depending where in the world they exist, right? Okay, I'll give you another example. We talk about media stuff, right? These two young girls who've been caught with drugs going to Ibiza, right? Let's be real. If they were Jamaican immigrants going back to Jamaica, do you think they'd be presented as victims? Right? And now I'm not saying what they did or didn't do. I don't know the specifics of the case. I'm just saying in my entire life, I've never seen two black Jamaican girls trying to smuggle drugs into a country being presented by the paper as people who've been bullied into it. Now, in reality, that probably does happen and probably has happened. to girls from Harsden or Tottenham or Brixton or wherever else. But their postcode, their skin colour, their background, all of those things, they don't have access to being humanised and presented in that way, right? And I doubt you'll ever see that in your life. And so to me, it's seeing through again, like I said, how these things, if we don't have to think about them, we don't, but how they're systemic. Another example, someone pointed out an article to me. There's a Twitter that I suggest you follow. It's called Everyday Sexism. It's quite interesting, right? And they posted a link the other day. A woman died. I think she died in a... Please don't quote me because it was hazy, but I think she died in a boating accident. But don't quote me on that. What I do remember about the article, what was quite shocking, this woman was a biochemist, a very successful woman. She was also an activist. She died, and the headline read, "Doctor's Wife Killed." Does that make sense? So a woman who's as accomplished as that, you know, she was a biochemist. She was there was like two major achievements she had. Not that that even means if she didn't have those achievements, she should be defined by what her husband does for a living. But it was very interesting that even a woman of that level of accomplishment was still just described as a side piece to a man. Does that make sense? But these are things we won't write and complain about. I didn't write to the newspaper and complain. These are things that are systemic and that are part of the culture that, if they don't affect us, we maybe don't have to tackle on a daily.
Hi. I think, yeah, leading on from that, there's a certain thing that privilege does afford us, and it's often people in position of privilege can only see people less privileged than themselves when it's in relation to themselves. So it's that whole idea where you tell a lot of men are taught, and boys are taught, you know, what if it was your sister or your wife or your mother? And it's like, no, what if she was a person? That whole thing. And there's this culture whereby we push less privileged people onto privileged people in relation to them, and we need to kind of dismantle that entirely and kind of push forward that idea that no, these people are people in their own right. They are women, they are children, they are not white, they are all of these things alone, and they can stand alone outside of these kind of structures that are bigger than them.
I think that's... Did we have one in this direction?
Yeah. It kind of goes back to the earlier point, but you're talking about how education comes from music, and basically I thought about if politicians were to say like the things that rappers rap about, there'd be complete uproar. But at the same time, most people probably have heard more rap than they have political speeches. So how can education really come from that if the people that are actually educating the younger generation are rappers? And when they say explicit content, it's usually just swearing that they get rid of. They don't actually get rid of the like explicit nature of the song. They just be like bleep out the certain words. Yeah. So how can that really be education? Like, I wonder what you thought about that, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me be clear. I'm not saying that all rappers educate young people. I'm saying, growing up, for me, when I was growing up, the most popular rappers around, remember, rap only became this massive mainstream commercial phenomenon late 90s, early 2000s. You had the occasional group pop through before then, in this country I'm talking about. In America, it was a little earlier, right? But the first rap album to go number one in this country was Wu-Tang Forever. I was 13 when Wu-Tang Forever came out. Now, if you listen to that album and what that album's saying, even the introduction to that album, the entire introduction to the album, for those who've never heard it, is a man, he's drinking, he's on drugs, he's got problems, he's abusing his wife, and he's talking to the head member of the Wu-Tang Clan, asking for guidance, right? That's how the album begins. He's saying, I'm lost, brother, can you help me? Can you help me? I'm doing all these crazy things, I'm insulting my woman, I'm fighting people that look like me for no reason, I'm doing it, right? So that's how the album begins. I'm saying, for me as a 13-year-old boy, the profound impact, now I'm not saying Wu-Tang didn't have, what they had and what I think made them so authentic, was they were not also painting over the issues. So you had 9 members of the group. You had ODB, who everyone knows had drug issues, right? And it's there in the name. For those who don't know what ODB stands for, go and look it up, right? And then you had the RZA and GZA. GZA is currently doing an album. This is one of the lead members of the Wu-Tang Clan, who's from one of the roughest parts of New York. He's currently working with a esteemed African-American physics professor called Michael deGrasse Tyson to do an album called Dark Matter, which is about physics, because that's what he's into, right? So what I'm saying is what Wu-Tang had was the full gamut, and what made them so powerful for me was that they were very human. You had the guy who was addicted to drugs. You had the guys who were like, yep, we used to be criminals, whether it was Ghostface Killer and Raekwon. You had the guy that loved Shaolin Kung Fu, which was the RZA, who's gone on to make his own Shaolin-inspired film. And then you had the GZA, right? And so for me, what hip-hop did was, or at least in a period, even commercial hip-hop offered us enough of a plethora of artists that if we wanted to pick KRS-One, right, who was one of the first rappers to go and lecture at Yale, It was one of the first people I ever saw give a lecture. If we wanted to pick Common, if we wanted to pick Mos Def, we could. Today, that option is massively reduced. Not because there aren't artists making that kind of music, but because, in my view, corporate power has seen what rap potentially could communicate in a particular period of time. And if we look at it in context, the largest record label in the world is owned by a French waste management company. Music is not their largest business. Does that make sense? So the idea that the music industry is just about profit, I would strongly disagree with. It's about culture, it's about politics, it's about what ideas we make popular and how that relates to these companies and these interests and everything else that they own. So I wouldn't say that mainstream rap educates anybody today. It clearly doesn't. And if it is education, it's a bad education, right? But I would say that there is, or at least certainly was for me, a massive impact that hip-hop had on my education, my desire to have knowledge. And that's why I've decided to make the kind of music that I try to make. And I think there's loads of other underground artists who do that. But then we've got to ask, why don't, you know, I've done, my next tour will be my sixth headline solo UK tour as an independent artist, right? And all of my tours have sold well, you know, but record labels are not beating down my door. Now, I've got friends in the music industry, or at least people that maybe are not my friends, but they make music, who didn't do any tours, but they made a particularly maybe negative song or a stereotypical song, they get on the radio, they get a record deal like that, right? If you're willing to play the same set of stereotypes. If you counteract those stereotypes, this society doesn't tend to want to expose you to a mainstream audience. And so I would say, again, when we look at rappers, we have to look at why is it those rappers you're listening to and not, I don't know, Immortal Technique or not Dead Prez or not, you know, someone else who's going to tell you something different. Those people can educate you, which is precisely why they're not being presented to you, in my view. Does that make sense? One, two, three. Yeah, one, two, three. But then someone will have to tell me 5 or 10 minutes before, because if you leave it to me, we'll be going forever. So we'll take these last three.
So, like, in relation to what you were saying about, like, the police, and then what you were saying about... So surely is it not, like, the fault of, like, government itself that education through music is educating people in the wrong way? Because, say, if you think government and, like, the radio and systems like that, they're promoting the wrong sort of music, which is therefore, like, setting a bad example for the youth, and then it just turns into, like, a cycle of self-fulfilling prophecy. So, like, what youths hear in the radio and what they hear in these songs, they're going to think that's what they want to do, and then they're just going to repeat it. So, in my view, it's, like, the government's fault, because they control media, they control music, they control everything. So they're controlling the minds of everyone through the music they promote. So surely that's not right.
But I mean, you are right. Our only national radio station is BBC. We pay a licence fee for that to exist. But you say they're promoting the wrong kind of messages. It's wrong to you. But depending on what their motivations are and what results they want to see, maybe they're playing exactly the right kind of music. You've got to ask yourself, right, what would be the implication, the political and social implication, if everyday working class people, just people generally, found education, proper education, political education, world in education, education on the foreign policy of this country. If that was popular entertainment instead of celebrity TV, Big Brother and OK Magazine, what would be the political ramifications of that, right? What would be the outcome if people had a much more revolutionary education? So the idea that because we have universal free education, that it's actually there to educate you is debatable. And what I mean by that is, it educates you within specific parameters. I'm not knocking it. As a person who's had the privilege to grow up in a country where basic education is free, I would never take that for granted. But also I see the contradictions in what I was and wasn't taught in school. What ideas were and were not exposed to me and why. And so what I would argue is you're saying the wrong things. I'm saying it's not an accident. There's a phrase that the ancient, they used to use in reference to ancient Rome called bread and circuses. The elite in Rome said, look, if you give poor people bread and circus, enough to eat and enough entertainment, they'll basically stay in their role, they won't affect you, they won't try and have any influence on the political process. We live in a country where, despite many of the privileges we have, a massively disproportionate amount of our government and our senior members of media and senior companies, not only do they look similar, not only are they from similar class backgrounds, they went to the same school and the same university. Right, so when you have a country governed that closely by that ideology, Eton and Oxbridge, you know, you've got to ask yourself how democratic that is. It might be democratic to the degree that you're allowed to go and vote, but in terms of influence on power, there are very few people outside of a select group that have any real influence on the power-making process in this country. And what we know about the history of power, not just in this country, but universally, is that people in power don't tend to say, oh, well, I've had enough of all this power and privilege, you know. It's really hard having all these millions of pounds to spend and, you know, all these people to control. Have some back. It doesn't go that way, right? And so I'm saying what is promoted to everyday children and what is promoted to... I've taught in private schools. So I can tell you, kids in private schools are not taught the way I was taught. When you go to a private school, if you debate with your teacher, you disagree with the teacher, you have other research or other information, that's called debate. How many of us who went to state schools, when we said, hold on a minute, maybe what you're teaching me isn't that accurate, I've got an opinion. That's called being rude when you go to a state school or when you go to a poor school. That's called being unruly, and that's called stepping out of your pram. So there is very different ways, in depending on your social status, the way in which you are educated. Now, what we've got to do, and I think the only thing we can do, is to take responsibility. Dr. M.K. Asante, who I referred to earlier, says take two sets of notes. You take the sets of notes you need for class to pass the test, to get the job you need, to do what you need to do to feed and sustain yourself, but you take two sets of notes. You take the other set that are for yourself, your own personal truths, your own extracurricular reading, your own kind of search, if you like. I think we've got time for two more. Was it one and then two?
Kind of leading on from what you were just talking about, I'm interested in how children and youth generally are disempowered by the, you know, you have no real say over what happens to you and your control of what happens to you, etc. You're treated as a minority, you don't get a vote, and there's a school started by a guy called A.S. Neil, a Scottish guy, started in the 1920s, and the kids can do what they want until they're 13, and then they think about what exams they might want to do, and then they can take GCSEs up until they're 17. And this school is private, privately owned, privately run. The government even tried to shut it down, and they won the court case, and then the new Ofsted are talking about trying to shut it down again. But the kids from day one get to choose what they want to learn about, and the teachers are there to facilitate their learning. So the kids are in the driving seat. And if you, the kids also, the whole school create the rules of the, they call it a community, not a school. The whole school create the rules, including teachers and children. And then if you break a rule, you have to basically stand up in front of everyone and talk about why you've broken it. And then they decide what your punishment should be. So it's all about kind of reconciliation. So I was just interested in that. It's called A.S. Neil Summerhill School. And there's a whole movement of democratic schools across the world. But this is a this is like the original form.
I'd love to look it up. Has anyone read the work of Paulo Freire? He's a Brazilian educator. He wrote a book called The Pedagogue of the Oppressed. I suggest everybody read it who's interested in what you're saying. And he's talking about approaches to education and the dictatorial process, which is what we all go through, versus a communal education. To me, you know, that's how I would have wanted to have gone to school, and how I think, particularly in a society such as this, a post-industrial society, we're not training masses of people to go and work in factories anymore. But the problem is, when you go to a communal school, when the danger, and this is what I mean about political implication, the danger of sending children to a school where they have a say in the curriculum, where they have a say in shaping their own future, where they have a say in power in process of punishment, is people get used to having a say. And then they leave school and still want to have a say. Then 3 million of them go and march and say, well, we don't believe this country should use our taxes to invade Iraq. And the government says, well, so what? We don't care what you think. We're going to do it anyway. So this is what I mean, is when you say they're trying to shut the school down, to me that seems very obvious reason for that, is because if this kind of behavior spreads, we can't have people that are supposed to have no say getting the idea that they're born to have a say. And this is the difficulty that you face and will face with that kind of education, even in a democracy, right? Because it's democratic within the degree to which you are not a threat to those in power, there is democracy. The moment what you're doing is a massive threat, you're going to come up against resistance and up against problems. And that's not conspiracy theory, that's history. Did you want to find?
Even the actual idea of democracy is getting together and voting on a decision and what's going to happen for the community. And, you know, a part of that is bowing down if everyone else thinks what you say is wrong. But in our society, what we have is, and throughout structures of hierarchy and stuff, is what we have is we vote for people that have run to be a leader. We don't actually get a choice on what they're going to do. We just vote for them to do whatever they want to do, basically.
We vote between two sets of similarly educated, similarly privileged, similarly rich people in this country, usually white men, to govern everybody else, right? and to and usually educated at the same schools and gone to the same universities to do for the country. We don't vote on any of the significant things. I'd much rather have had a vote on whether or not we invaded Iraq than I would on which person that I don't relate to sits in the seat while we do it. Does that make sense? But we're not going to vote on the actual action. We're going to vote. It's personality politics. It's what do we do about it is the question. But that's just my opinion. You know, maybe the majority of the country doesn't feel that way because maybe they feel catered to by those people.
Hiya. I was just going to go back to what you were saying about kind of policing and the stuff that you guys were talking about. Nowadays, if you, like, watch a film that's a 12, it can become a 12 because there's a lady who's got her shirt off or something like that. And there's such strict rules on things like a certain amount of centimetres of a woman's buttocks and it becomes a 12 or a 15 or whatever. There's so much policing on that kind of thing, and we protect our children so much from that and things like sex. But then stuff like a song which promotes rape culture can be number one and it's allowed to be like that. And I'm not saying that kind of taking that out and saying we can't have that kind of stuff is right, because when I was doing my GCSE English, there was a poem in our anthology called The Knife. And it was by Carol Ann Duffin. It was basically a poem about this woman. It was basically about a knife and her considering using a knife on someone. And it actually got removed from the anthology because they believed it was kind of promoting knife crime. And they left the page blank when they removed it. So, of course, everyone just went and looked up what the poem was about. And that was, like, the most exciting poem in the whole book because it wasn't there. So I'm not saying that saying you shouldn't watch it or people can't listen to it is a good way, because then, obviously, it kind of goes underground. I'm just wondering if you had any ideas of what we can do about that kind of thing.
I mean, violence exists, right? Protecting, but it's about what we do and don't protect people from. So, for example, if I did a lecture to a group of 10, 8, 7-year-olds about war, and I showed them what war actually looks like, people would say I'm being radical, I'm being horrible, I shouldn't expose them. But hold on a minute, we're at war. You know, it's about what you do and don't. So we can have films and entertainment that show graphic scenes of violence, even graphic scenes of rape, and sort of mythologize it and make pornography of it. But what we can't have is a reality of, well, this is what happens when you go to war with people. This is what children look like when you drop bombs on their village, right? If you expose people to that, you're now being controversial, but that is reality. Now, you can rap about it and mythologize it and make it pornography, and especially if you're a young black male, you can rap about killing other young black men. Everyone finds that perfectly entertaining. Should you ever step out of your pram and expand what you're saying or contradict or devalue any other group of humans' lives, it will be a problem. I'm not suggesting we remove things that are controversial, that are difficult, that are sensitive subjects. I'm suggesting that the way they're dealt with publicly is never accidental, is never. And it's not about calling things conspiracy or not conspiracy. It's about a culture. And so if the mainstream media and things of that nature are controlled and governed by a particular culture, by people educated in a particular way to view things a particular way, the output, we have to learn to have the tools to decode why we're reading that story and not that story, in my opinion. Why we're reading that story from that perspective and not get this ridiculous idea. What often happens with rappers like us, right, is people say, they're conscious rappers or they're political rappers. No one ever labels the negative rappers. Does that make sense? And there's a reason for that. You're marginalized as being conscious, as if the assumption then is that there's some sort of apolitical norm. If I'm rapping about French champagne, Italian clothes and German cars, that's a political decision. I'm not rapping about green tea, which is the equivalent of champagne in China. In China, they sell some green tea for $25,000, right? Because their cultural equivalent of champagne is green tea. Now, I've made a decision as an African-American rapper to rap about French culture. That's a political decision, but it's not presented that way because it enforces the dominant narrative. And I would just say, in terms of changing and having influence on that, it is possible. There are many things that are talked about in a public sphere today. And ironically, even though America in many ways is such a non-democracy, there are also many voices in America, radical voices, that are heard within mainstream American culture that you'd never get on the radio or the television in a mainstream way here, which is interesting. So on the one hand, you have much greater repression, much higher levels of poverty, much the highest levels of violence in the developed world by a country mile, the highest levels of incarceration in the entire world. America locks up more of its people than any country in history ever, right? But yet this is the country we look to for guidance. But yet you still have certain voices saying that publicly. Here we have similarly disproportionate racial and class ratios in the prison system. No one's saying it publicly. No one's even questioning it. No one's relating it to history. So I would say it's about us trying to force those opinions to be heard by what decisions we make with what we spend on. It's about us, if we get fed up of something or particular narratives, writing letters of complaint, of signing petitions, doing everything we can do to basically A, have the tools to decode what we see, and B, to influence what we see so that other young minds and older minds are exposed to a wider array of views and ideas, because that's what democracy is supposed to be about, right? It's supposed to be about free speech and a wide range of opinions being heard or given a platform to a certain degree. Have we got time for one more? Are we done? Okay, we've got time for one last, if anyone's got a parting shot. There we go. We've got one here. It's been great speaking to you, by the way. Some very good questions, some great observations.
Well, it was just some of the stuff you said about racism in one of your raps. It made me think, because, I mean, I go to a private school and I think I'm quite well off and I've got quite a good life and I'm lucky. And I've never experienced racism because, I mean, I've gone to schools where people they don't care. And I just wanted to say that I think it's really, it just seems so stupid that why we should judge people for who they are, like, not for their personalities and not for how they act, but for what they look like. Yeah. And also, what you were saying, you're saying something about, like, how we're only human and we all judge people. And I realised that I actually judge people by what they look like every time I see someone. But I think it's just about trying not to let that affect the way you behave around them. And I think now I'm more aware of racism and stuff that's happening in the world.
Well, you're right, and in an ideal world, these things shouldn't be issues. But to say that racism is illogical, that's obvious, but it is also logical in the sense that we have to differentiate between individual acts of bigotry, which is what I was saying at the beginning. Individual acts of bigotry exist in all cultures, in all places, everywhere in the world. There are individuals who think you look different, you've got a different religion, you're the wrong gender, whatever it is, and I don't like you for that reason. There's individual bigotry and there's collective systemic racism. They're two very different things. And it's important that we understand the difference and how one came to exist. Does that make sense? So the idea, there's a very good book called The Invention of the White Race. The idea that there is such a thing as a white race, as that white Western Europeans represent one homogenous group, is a very new idea. We're not taught that way. We're taught to believe that in ancient Greece and Rome and everywhere else, it was similarly homogenous. No, it wasn't. The Roman legion that invaded England was a North African legion. So you had so-called white people from Italy using their North African legion to invade a so-called other white country. History is much more complicated than that. Ancient Greece was a multicultural civilization. And of course, you had civilizations in Africa, be it Egypt or Sudan or India and other places, long, long time before you had those in this part of the world. The invention of the idea of white and black in racial terms and assigning a category of value is probably only about 400 years old. That has existed to a certain degree before then, and there was a morphology called the Curse of Ham. So the idea was that Africans were descendants. It was a biblical prophecy used in Islam, in Judaism, and Christianity to say that Africans were the children of Ham. The mythology of Ham was that Ham saw his father naked and was punished by that and then was eternally deemed to be a slave. That mythology had existed, but systemic assigning of categories and legal status in a society based on skin color, as far as I know, began in 1619 in America. And it was to justify the enslavement of Africans and solely Africans. Again, that didn't happen because they were African. It happened as part of a historical process. I'm giving this explanation so that it's a bit of a long-winded explanation. It will be my last point, but so that we can understand, as I said, which I think is very, very important, individual bigotry and collective systemic racism, which is two very different things. And as slavery in America came to be solely racialized, this idea of, because the people that came into America, originally they had indentured servants from Ireland, from Scotland, they were enslaving Native Americans. Like any civilization before it, be it the Vikings, be it the Romans, be it the Greeks, slavery was not racialized. People enslaved whoever the hell they had the power to enslave. Once Native Americans were dying out and the working class people from here that were sent to the Caribbean, so it used to be it would be said you were Barbadoed. That meant to be sent to Barbados for committing a crime, right? Once those groups of people started to die out for various genetic reasons and Africans became the only people that survived, there became a need to justify for profit solely enslaving this group of people. And in my view, that's where modern racism began. And it isn't illogical, it's profit. We have to understand that if I have a business, if I'm Apple, and I can dehumanize, think about how big Apple is as a corporation. Because slavery as a business was more profitable than any corporation that exists today. And think about how profitable Apple and others are. If I can say, this group of people are all not human, therefore they should work for me for free, that's a pretty genius business model, right? If I'm greedy, obviously, and I'm not a very nice person, right? So you have a scenario where you have an entire business built on racism. And then the legacy of that in America and in Europe to some degree, but in America massively and in Europe, like I said, in a more complicated way because we didn't have Jim Crow in the same way. When that ends, you get what's called Jim Crow laws. Now, the Jim Crow laws were not illogical. This is what people don't understand. People talk about segregation. It wasn't segregation. It was affirmative action for white people. But no one wants to present it that way. They present it as segregation. No, it was reservation of the best services, goods, schools, places to eat for solely people that were white. Does that make sense? Even though everybody paid tax in America, so African Americans didn't get any tax reduction because they weren't allowed to go to places, right? They still were expected to pay the same rates of tax as everybody else. But all of the best facilities, best universities, best schools were reserved from the 1870s to 1965 for white people. And so it's important that we understand that as a systemic issue versus me just individually saying, I don't like your hair or I think, you know, you don't look right. Does that make sense? And I think it's much harder to deal with the second systemic issue because it makes people feel uncomfortable. It makes people feel like they haven't earned what they have. It is a much more difficult and subtle, nuanced issue to deal with, but it is very real and it has very real implications. And that goes for sexism and classism too. Those are not accidents. Those are systemic. And I think that, again, educating ourselves about the difference and not allowing these issues to be trivialized, calling a woman a name is one thing. The fact that all over the world, women get raped and it's not taken terribly seriously, really, right, is something completely different, right? And we shouldn't trivialize and confuse the two. And that's one thing I really think is important and people should take away, is the difference between that systemic top-down culture of bigotry and individual. This is my last point. I can see you there saying it's time to finish. But they try and individuate, they try and elevate individual wallies like the EDL or the BNP and say they're the problem. You see what I mean? These are the racist people. These are the bigots. We're terribly lovely. But the BNP and the EDL don't invade anyone else's countries, don't manufacture any weapons, don't have the power to systemically affect the lives of racist way. Does that make sense? What they do have the power to do is go around and chat a whole lot of rubbish and maybe attack people in the street. But they're not. That's not the whole issue. So, yeah, that would be my parting thoughts. Thank you.
Can I just say, Akayla, thank you. Thank you for sharing some of your story, and also thank you for being part of our education. If you've enjoyed this, guys, let Greenbelt know.